Pull up a chair. Go on, grab that folding one by the wingtip. The shade's better over here anyway, you feel that? That warm asphalt coming up through your boots, the smell of cut grass and 100 low lead drifting over from the fuel pumps. Somewhere off to the north, a radial is coughing itself awake, and every 30 seconds, another airplane is greasing it on out on runway 36, while 100,000 people crane their necks. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar. And this week, the whole world comes to a little field in Wisconsin. We're standing in the home-built rows this morning, the canard rows, specifically. You know the ones. Those funny-looking airplanes with the little wing up front and the big wing in back. The ones that look like they're flying backward. Longies, Verrieses, Cozy, Defiant. Burt Rutan's children, all of them. And I want to tell you a story that starts right here, among these composite oddballs that half the crowd walks past without a second look, because one of these bloodlines flew around the entire planet, alone, without stopping, without taking on a single drop of fuel, and it did it inside my lifetime and probably inside yours. Before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And brother, this next one's a story worth a coin. Go see them at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. It's the winter of 2005. Salina, Kansas, flat, brown, cold. The kind of place where the wind never quits and the horizon just runs off in every direction. There's a runway there, a long one left over from the days when it was an Air Force base. And sitting on that runway is the strangest looking flying machine you ever saw. They called it the Global Flyer. And it looked less like an airplane than like something a spider might build. If you gave it carbon fiber and a grudge, one long skinny fuselage in the middle, no bigger around than a coffin. A single jet engine perched up top on the tail like a hood ornament, and then these two enormous booms running out to either side, each one a fuel tank with a little tail of its own, all of it tied together by a wing that stretched wider than a business jet's. Here's the thing you have to understand. That airplane was almost nothing but gasoline, kerosene, I should say, jet fuel. When they fueled her up, better than 80% of the entire weight of that machine was fuel. 80%. Think about that. You climb into your Cessna, top off the tanks, and fuel's maybe a fifth of what you're hauling. This thing was a flying fuel tank with a man tucked into a crevice in the middle of it. And that man was Steve Fawcett. Now, if you don't know Fawcett, let me paint him for you, because he's a piece of work in the best way. Made his money in the financial markets in Chicago, but money to Fawcett was just fuel for adventure. He swam the English Channel, he raced dog sleds in the Iditarod, he drove in the 24 hours of Le Mans, he set records in sailboats and gliders and balloons. The man had a hunger for the edge of things that just would not quit. He'd already flown a balloon solo around the world, the first man ever to do it, after five tries that nearly killed him more than once. Ditched one of them in the Coral Sea after falling thousands of feet in a thunderstorm. So this was not a fellow who scared easy, but this airplane, this flight, this was a different kind of animal. Now here's where it gets interesting. Burt Rutan built this thing. Same mind that gave us those little canards out here on the grass. Same shop, scaled composites out in the Mojave Desert that a year earlier had put a man into space in a home built and won the Ansari X Prize. And the challenge Rutan's team took on was this: build an airplane that could fly farther than any airplane had ever flown, on one load of fuel, with no refueling, all the way around the Earth, and do it solo. The Rutan brothers, Bert and Dick and Gianna Yeager, had flown Voyager around the world nonstop back in 1986, but that took two pilots, 9 days, and by the end that airplane was held together by prayer and duct tape. This was going to do it solo and a jet, so faster. The whole planet in under 3 days. The math was brutal. To carry that much fuel, the airplane had to be feather light and gossamer thin. But a wing that long and loaded that heavy is a fragile thing. On the runway before she had flying speed, those wingtips drooped so low they nearly dragged. The engineers actually worried the wings might flex and fail just sitting there full of fuel. This was an airplane living right at the ragged edge of what physics would allow, no margin, none. The launch was set for the end of February, and they needed a jet stream, a tailwind up high to push her along and stretch the fuel. They needed the weather over three quarters of the Earth to cooperate all at once. Picture Fawcett climbing in, and I mean climbing in, because there was no cockpit to speak of. A tube, a reclined seat you couldn't stand up from. Room to shift your weight, and that's about it. 67 hours he was going to live in a space smaller than the bench seat of a pickup truck. No autopilot he could fully trust to leave alone. No bathroom worth the name. Food was milkshakes, diet milkshakes, because he couldn't afford the weight of anything more. They fired that single engine, and she rolled. And this is the part that'll put your heart in your throat. Loaded that heavy, she needed nearly the entire runway to stagger into the air. Slow, mushing. Wallowing off the ground like an overloaded goose, and she was carrying so much fuel that if anything had gone wrong in those first minutes, there was no coming back. You cannot land an airplane that heavy. You'd fold the gear and the whole thing would go up like a torch. He was committed the instant those wheels left Kansas. She climbed, slow and steady, up into the cold, thin air, up toward the jet stream, and Steve Fawcett pointed the nose east and started chasing the sunrise around the world. Now let me tell you what that's like, because it's not the smooth cruise you might imagine. Up high alone, night falls and there's nothing, no lights below when you're over the ocean. Just the faint glow of the instruments and the hiss of the engine and the cold seeping into that thin composite shell. He's crossing the Atlantic, then North Africa, the Middle East. He's threading between weather systems he can't see, trusting people on the ground who are watching the whole planet's forecast and radioing him corrections. And over the Pacific, the thing every pilot dreads, turbulence. That long, fragile wing, loaded down, getting knocked around, he's exhausted, he's cramped. He hasn't really slept, catnaps of a few minutes, because you cannot truly leave an airplane like this to fly itself for long. Warm milkshakes and catnaps and a wing you're praying holds together. And then, somewhere out over the Pacific, the gut punch. The fuel readings didn't add up. Somewhere in the climb out or early on, they figured they'd lost fuel. A couple thousand pounds of it, gone, maybe vented overboard, maybe never fully loaded. Nobody was completely sure. And on a flight where the whole point was that every single pound of fuel had a job to do, losing a couple thousand pounds was very possibly the end of the whole attempt. Fawcett and the team on the ground had to make the call. Out over the middle of the biggest ocean on Earth, do you press on and risk running the tanks dry short of the finish, coming down in the dark somewhere over land with a dead engine? Or do you quit, put her down in Hawaii or Japan, and come home having failed? They ran the numbers. And the numbers just barely said keep going. The tailwinds had been good. The engine was sipping fuel more efficiently up high than they'd dared hope. It would be close, knife edge close, but it might, just might be enough. He kept going, back across the Pacific, over Japan behind him now, then the long haul home. And this is the part that gets me every time. As he came back across the west coast of the United States and out over the Great Plains, back toward Kansas where he'd started, the fuel gauges were reading almost empty. He was flying on fumes and faith. That single jet engine, which if it so much as hiccuped had no backup, just kept turning. And on the 13th hour of the third day, 67 hours after he'd staggered off that Kansas runway, Steve Fawcett brought the Global Flyer back down out of the sky and set it on the very same runway. At Salina, first person in history to fly solo, nonstop, without refueling, all the way around the world. Better than 23,000 miles, one man, one tank, one engine, one wing that everybody had been afraid to trust. When they checked what was left in the tanks, there was almost nothing. He'd landed on a whisper. Now think about where that airplane came from. Not from Boeing, not from Lockheed, not from some vast government program with a budget the size of a small country. It came from a shop in the desert run by a fellow who cut his teeth building airplanes for people just like the folks camped out here in the North 40. The same design language, the composites, the efficiency, the willingness to make an airplane look flat out weird if that's what the physics wanted, that's Rutan. And Rutan is EAA. Rutan is Oshkosh, that whole revolution in what a small team could build in a hangar. It grew up right here, in the culture of this field. Walk these canard rows again with that in your head, those little long izzes and very izzes with the pusher props and the wing on backward. They're cousins to the airplane that flew around the world on one tank. Same family tree? Some home builder sitting in his garage in the 1970s, sanding foam and fiberglass off Burt Rutan's plans, was part of the same story that ended with a man circling the earth alone. That's the thing about this place. The line between the home built on the grass and the world record in the history books is a lot shorter than most people ever realize. And here's the bittersweet part. The part I'll leave you with before I let you get back to the flight line. Steve Fawcett's number came up a couple years later. Not on some grand adventure across an ocean. On a routine flight in a little airplane over the mountains of Nevada. Went missing on what should have been a nothing hop, and it took better than a year to find where he'd gone down. The man who'd survived balloon crashes into the sea and flown fragile machines around the whole planet, gone doing the ordinary thing. And maybe there's a lesson in that for all of us walking this flight line. The mountain doesn't care how many records you hold, the airplane doesn't know you're famous. Every flight asks the same respect. The record setter and the 200-hour private pilot both fly the ordinary hop like it's the around-the-world one. That's the ticket. Most of what I told you today comes from the folks at Scaled Composites who built her, from Steve Fawcett's own accounts of the flight, and from the good people who covered it for the aviation press back in 2005. Go read it in his own words if you get the chance. It's better than anything I can give you. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. But right now, close your eyes for a second and listen. That's a Merlin warming up over in Warbird Alley, and the sky over Whitman Field is about to fill up. Go watch some airplanes. I'll see you out there.